This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Spotlight on Africa, analysis of elections in Rwanda and Kenya, and looking ahead to Angola. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. First, to Rwanda. No surprise there. President Paul Kagame handily won the election with almost 99% of the vote, extending his 17-year rule until at least 2024. Mr. Kagame, a former rebel, is credited with engineering Rwanda's economic transformation from the ruins of the 1994 genocide to one of the star economic performers on the continent. Critics ask, however, if he has done this at the expense of free speech and assembly. Human rights groups accuse Kagame of using state power to intimidate as well as jail and eliminate opponents. Moving on to Kenya, where citizens went to the polls on August 8th for a high-stakes election with clear ethnic overtones, pitting President Uhuru Kenyatta of the Kikuyu tribe against his rival Raila Odinga, who is a Luo. You may recall in 2007, the tightly contested race devolved into ethnic violence that left 1,200 dead. Kenyatta and his current vice president, William Ruto, were among those charged by the International Criminal Court for inciting violence. Both cases were later dropped. Unfortunately, despite Kenya's success and modernization, it's dubbed a beacon of the continent, its elections still seem to be decided on the basis of ethnicity. In this current go-round, Odinga, who is trailing Kenyatta by several percentage points, has charged that the election was tainted by massive fraud. His claims sparked protests on August 9th in several areas of Nairobi, Kisumu, and in the Tana River region. However, the chairman of Kenya's election commission claimed its voting system was hacked 1 week before the election, but that it was not compromised. And on August 23rd, Angolans head to the polls. And for the first time, President José Eduardo dos Santos, the 74-year-old leader who has been in power for 38 years and Africa's second longest serving leader, will not run for another term. João Lourenço is his hand-picked successor. He is an MPLA party veteran who enjoys strong ties to the military. He is widely expected to be president given his party's dominance. Well, for more on the implications of these elections on the future of Africa and its relations with the United States, we talk with two regional analysts. Bronwyn Bruton is Deputy Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and that's a think tank based here in Washington. And Joshua Meservey. He's Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation. And from 2006 to 2009, Joshua served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Zambia. Both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Well, first to you, Bronwyn Bruton, to talk about Rwanda. There's no surprise, Paul Kagame won. So my question to you is, does his victory, in your view, illustrate a lack of viable opposition because the state is somewhat repressive or perceived to be repressive? Or is it more because after the 1994 genocide, in which there was glaring incitement to violence by Hutus against Tutsis, that the political system is simply sort of more cautious? How do you see his victory?
It's difficult to assess, frankly. In some respects, it's a chicken and egg question. Certainly in Rwanda, you have a government that is a one-man show. Paul Kagame is the state. He really is. And so I think it's very hard to separate the idea of governance in Rwanda and politics in Rwanda from his personality. And there is no question that the Rwandan government has been repressive when it comes to political freedoms, and that the lack of a viable political opposition has a lot to do with the fact that politicians who are not members of the ruling party really don't have the freedom to operate. And that is a reinforcing cycle. And so I think it's hard to disentangle them.
Joshua Meservey, Bronwyn Bruton's comment, Kagame is the state, reminds me of, you know, l'état, c'est moi. I mean, how do you see his victory and his trajectory?
Yeah, I agree with Bronwyn's assessment of Kagame being the dominant political force in that country. He has been really since 1994 after the genocide ended. Now, I think also that there is a lot of caution that you referenced in your run-up remarks, because this trauma of the 1994 genocide is still very fresh, and it was so awful that there's a real fear of anything that could tilt them back into that sort of chaos. Now, the government policies actually exacerbate this in some respects, because they have so thoroughly dominated the narrative around the genocide and not allowed other voices, particularly from the Hutu side, some of whom suffered as well, to be heard. So I think it's a somewhat toxic environment there.
Turning back to you, Bronwyn, to talk about the situation in Rwanda, how would you characterize the repression? Do you think Paul Kagame goes too far, notwithstanding the trauma of 1994, the genocide? Is he as repressive as some human rights groups say he is, jailing opponents, even disappearances, and really very repressive tactics?
This is a very hard question to answer. I mean, you're looking at a country, Rwanda, that had a horrific genocide. And when we as Western analysts look at the country, it's difficult for us to understand and to apply our human rights and democratic norms to it, because we come from a society where, even now, when we're struggling in the United States through a period of great social dissonance, we have a shared foundation. We really do have a shared foundation, and Rwanda does not. And I cannot imagine, as an American, what it would be like to govern a country where you don't have a fundamental trust in your neighbors. And when you've experienced a genocide, and when people have been hacked to death by individuals that they've walked down the street with every day for years, I mean, this is an unimaginable kind of disruption. And I think that to expect that Rwanda is going to look the way that a Western democracy looks is not realistic in any way, shape, or form. That being said, however, the leaders of the country, and Paul Kagame specifically, has been in power for so long. And I think that what that does is make it very easy for his own political well-being to be confused with Rwanda's political well-being. And I do think that if you look at governance in Rwanda, there are numerous instances that you can point to, including arrests, disappearances, the total stifling of language even that occurs. And you can say, well, this is going too far, or this is not so much about Rwanda as it is about the continuation of Paul Kagame's individual rule. That is where I think Western critics can legitimately lay blame at the government's door.
Joshua Mazurvi, do you think that it's time now for Paul Kagame, and is he even capable of just opening up a bit, you know, being able to distinguish between legitimate criticism of his ruling and incitement to violence that would hark back to the genocide?
Yeah, it's extraordinarily difficult. I don't know Paul Kagame, so I don't know if he can make that distinction. It does appear that his regime is very unwilling to tolerate anything approaching what many of us would consider legitimate critiques of his government. Again, this stems from perhaps an understandable place. So to expect that it's an easy decision to just say, as a Tutsi, which is still very much a minority tribe in that country, to just open up the political system and give the Hutus, which were primarily the perpetrators of the violence, the opportunity to take control of the government again, when there are so many unresolved grievances, when the wounds are still so fresh, that is a difficult decision and a difficult calculus. I think that there are instances where this regime has gone too far. I think the long-term health of the country does require that Paul Kagame or whoever succeeds him begin this process of opening up the country, allowing legitimate political dissent, and allowing really healing and reconciliation around what happened in 1994.
We'll go to a break, and then we'll talk about Kenya. First, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Joshua Mazurvi. He's Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation, and that's a Washington-based think tank, and Bronwyn Brouton. She's Deputy Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, also based in Washington. We're discussing the outcome and significance of the elections in Rwanda, and soon we'll talk about Kenya and look ahead to the Angolan election later this month. This is a reminder that our Encounter Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Now here's a shout out to a very loyal listener from Nairobi, Kenya, Ray Ondoro. And Ray, thank you always for listening and sending such insightful emails. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Also, we'd like to know what you think of VOA's Encounter and would appreciate it if you would take a brief online survey. You can find it on our Facebook page at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on our webpage at voanews.com/encounter and click on the About tab. Well, back to you, Bronwyn Brewton, and let's talk about Kenya because things are really very dicey there at the moment. What do you make of the allegations of voting fraud by challenger Raila Odinga? Do you think there is justification for that? Because polls showed a much closer race running up to the vote.
Again, you know, I really hate to answer every single question with, gee, it's hard to say. But gee, it's hard to say. The problem is that allegations of fraud in Kenya are always believable. And whether or not fraud took place in this particular instance is going to require very close scrutiny. And it has to be the kind of scrutiny that is conducted publicly so that individuals who are on the street wondering if an election was stolen from their candidate feel confident that the grievances and the concerns that they've expressed are actually being addressed. And in this particular election, because of the murder of Chris Msando, the IEBC official who was so instrumental in guaranteeing a free and fair poll, and because of, as you mentioned, Carol, the discrepancy in recent polling data. Back in January, Kenyatta had a big lead in polling in July. That appeared to have closed. So we really don't know what's been happening. And because we really don't have reliable exit polling, which you would normally have in an election of this importance. And because election officials themselves have been so cautious and slow in tallying votes and forwarding responses, we have a period of real uncertainty and anxiety. And to the Kenyan public's credit, they've mostly not taken to the street. They've mostly waited patiently. But I'd point out that they did that in 2007 as well. And it was only when the courts came out with the decision that they felt to be unjust that the violence erupted. And so I would say we're nowhere near out of the woods.
Turning to you, Joshua Mazerve, with respect to Chris Msando, who was murdered, evidently. He was an Electoral Commission official. What do you think is the relationship between his death, because he had access to the computerized voting system. He was found with signs of torture. What is, in your view, a potential relationship between that and what we're seeing today, the voting fraud allegations by Raila Odinga?
The murder and what appeared to be the torture of this man was deeply concerning, of course, and I think it set off a lot of red flags for people who were following this election carefully and were looking for signs of potential problems. Now, I want to be very cautious because we have no idea who killed him. And there is criminality, of course, in Nairobi, and quite bad criminality sometimes. So we don't know if this was simply an ordinary, so to speak, crime where that just went terribly wrong, or if indeed it was election related. And I'm not going to speculate on that part of this. I will say the effect it had was very negative because the optics alone are obviously terrible, particularly because he was the ICT manager for the IEBC. And in the last go-around in Kenyan elections, it was electronic failures of their new voting system that caused a lot of angst. Something like more than 50% of the electronic voter IDs failed.
This was in 2013.
Yes, exactly. And so whenever there's some sort of anomaly, glitch, whatever it is, that immediately arouses suspicions in a context where people are already deeply suspicious and looking for evidence of wrongdoing, tampering, fraud. So I think the effect of his death was very negative, of course, because it fit a certain narrative that was already being circulated throughout the country that there was going to be tampering and rigging. And so people saw it as evidence of their fears already coming true.
Bronwyn Brewton, do you think the Kenyan people are confident that the government will be able to find out who was behind this killing? Because it seems to me that this is going to be very important, as well as look at the allegations of voter fraud.
I don't know if they can find the culprit. I sincerely hope so. Obviously, there is video footage of the people who actually committed the killing, so hopefully identifying them and getting them to talk will help. I think in the short term, though, what's important to keep our eye on is that we need to assume that the killing was connected to the election, because the people who are on the ground and in a position to cause violence are likely to assume that it was connected to the election. And so officials in Kenya need to be responding to that worst case scenario. They need to be reassuring the people who are suspicious that this was an attempt to influence the election and to ensure that the election went, you know, a certain way. I believe that the IEBC is doing its best. I am disappointed and concerned that some of the statements coming out of the IEBC have been conflicting. Various people, the commissioner, the CEO, have said different things about whether hacking took place. They've pretty much all said that the hacking was not successful. But when you have statements that don't seem to line up, that in itself is cause for concern. And so I am disheartened a little bit by the failure of the IEBC in this case to present a united front and to really send a strong message about what has and hasn't taken place. To me, that's something to be very worried about.
Are you equally worried, Joshua? Now, IEBC, we're talking about, is the acronym for?
For the election board in Kenya, that's right.
I am worried. I think in these sorts of very volatile, very fragile situations, no communication is perfect. It has to be as near perfect as it possibly can be. And yes, when you have conflicting statements coming out from the body in charge of tallying these results, of ultimately proclaiming the president of Kenya, that simply feeds people's fears and worries around the watertightness of the process. So I agree with Bronwyn's assessment that they're doing the best they can, but they need to clean some things up very quickly, and they need to move forward in as transparent and as credible a manner as possible.
Before we turn to Angola, one more question, Bronwyn, about Kenya. Do you agree that the elections in Kenya have, until date, sort of been decided on the basis of ethnicity, you know, pitting the Kikuyu and maybe Kalenjin tribe against Luo and others? And what do you think this election is all about? Is it Raila Odinga has to become president one day eventually since he keeps running? You know, what's at stake? Are there even any real ideological differences between these two candidates? What are the issues at stake? Or is it really identity politics?
When it comes to the nature of election in Kenya, it's important to remember, I think, that not very long ago, in 2002, Kenya had a transformative moment. It was one of the only African nations ever to peacefully vote out of power a president for life, Moi. He was forced to step down. And ever since that occurred, the importance of elections has been foundational in Kenya. There is a respect for elections, a sort of a sacredness about the electoral process in Kenya that I think is very hard to overlook when we're so focused on all the shenanigans that seem to take place around them. Kenyans respect elections. And in my view, a lot of the violence surrounding 2007, while it certainly played out on tribal lines and the escalation of violence had to do with retaliation for one tribe's violence against another, fundamentally, it was about outrage that an election was clearly not conducted properly. And out of all the people who were there, local observers, international observers, the millions of dollars that had gone into it, nobody was willing to do anything about it. After just a few days, the courts ruled that Kenyatta should be the president. I'm sorry, that back then it was Kibaki. Kibaki <Right. laughs> should be the president. And everyone, you know, from Washington to London immediately jumped in and said, yes, he's the president. This is great. Let's move on. And that was when the violence started. So fundamentally, I think as members of the international community, yes, we need to understand all of the tribal politics in Kenya. And yes, unfortunately, tribalism is still the modus operandi of political life in Kenya, and there's no getting around that. But we have a responsibility to the Kenyan voters to make sure that for whatever reason they vote, whether it's on tribal lines or not, that their vote matters. And I think that's where we're falling short and where the Kenyan government is falling short.
Joshua, Bronwyn makes some very interesting points, but quickly to you with respect to what do you see is at stake in this election? Do you see ideological or philosophical differences between Odinga and Kenyatta? Is it more of a power grab or a desire for power? Or do you see this ethnic overtones constantly creeping in?
I think a lot of the differences between the two major candidates are on the margins, frankly. I don't see vast ideological differences or even policy differences. I think, unfortunately, there are tribal dynamics here. Particularly, you look at 2007, the violence kicked off in the Rift Valley, which traditionally has been a hot spot for tribal tension. And unscrupulous political leaders know that the best way to mobilize support is through ethnic appeals, unfortunately, in many societies in Africa and elsewhere. So I think that there is very much a tribal dynamic, and that actually increases the stakes of an election. And there are scholars have written about this, but that's why sometimes you see violence so easily break out, because it's more of a winner-take-all system than in more mature democracies, for instance, or longer-lasting democracies, let me say that. So I think that makes just a very volatile, very fragile, very dangerous situation. And it's always a minority that kicks off this sort of violence. So I'm really hoping that despite the concerns we have and the violence we have seen already, that the majority wins out here, the majority that's committed to peace.
Well, let's turn briefly to Angola before we close the show. Angola on 23rd will be going to the polls. Bronwyn, I know you met João Lourenço at the Atlantic Council. One basic question, I mean, it's an oil-rich country, mineral-rich, diamonds, and yet we see all of these resources and the wealth pretty much concentrated among the elite, very little space for, as I said, you know, speech and dissenting voices. How do you see the importance of the significance of this election?
You know, unfortunately, it's no longer an oil-rich country. Because of the collapse of commodity prices that started in 2008, the Angolan government, which was for a long time just swimming in oil wealth, is actually in a severe state of deficit. So much so that Angola is looking a lot like Venezuela in many respects, where people don't have needles to get vaccinations, they've run out of malaria medication, they have the worst yellow fever outbreak that we've seen in decades, unemployment is staggeringly high. And this is the environment that Lourenço, who is a ruling party guy, an MPLA guy, a general, a former liberation fighter, someone very close to the president, Dos Santos, who's been in charge of Angola for 37 years. This is the environment that he's coming into. When he was named as the successor of Dos Santos, there was a lot of surprise because people thought that he would try to put one of his children in office. But I think the reason that he didn't was that there is at least a clear recognition in Angola that things have to change at this point. There's widespread concern about the lack of diversification in the economy and a complete recognition that Angola will not be able to diversify its economy if they don't fight the perception of corruption. Unfortunately, a number of people who've tried to invest in Angola have been burned by corruption. Lourenço, though he is close to Dos Santos, so he is an MPLA guy, has never been attached to any major corruption scandals. And so in that sense, the government is hoping that he will be perceived as a new leaf. And I think the question is, yes, he will win the elections. There's no doubt about it. But the real question is, how will investors and how will the market react to his election? He has to be a candidate of continuity, but he also has to be a candidate of change. And it's a difficult line to walk.
And Joshua, you get the last word on what you're expecting from the Angolan election. And my question to you is the age of nepotism over in Angola, where Dos Santos puts his daughter or son or whomever over major parts of the economy, even though we have a certain amount of continuity with the MPLA candidate?
I certainly hope it's over. I'm not so hopeful that nepotism won't remain a very prominent factor in Angolan politics. Dos Santos's daughter is potentially one of the richest women on earth. As a young woman was put in charge of major parts of the Angolan economy, that's not going to change with Lourenço's almost certain election. I hope that Lourenço can address some of these economic issues that Bronwyn brought up, because Angola fell into this trap of over-reliance on a specific commodity, oil in this case, and they just didn't diversify the economy. They didn't lay the foundations for a strong, prosperous, resilient economy, and now they're really suffering because of it. To me, that is Lourenço's major challenge coming in. I hope that he's also committed to the fight against nepotism and corruption. That might be a hope too far.
And perhaps allowing people to speak out without being repressed and penalized. Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Joshua Mazurvi. He's senior policy analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation, and Bronwyn Brouton. She's deputy director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. Thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Joe Gill. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.